You're listening to VCJ, Victoria College Jazzy.
Oh no, I'd forgotten that I hate this one even more than I hate all the rest of this light jazz, so this one's going. Okay, circular motion. Circular motion is quite a difficult concept because you've got to get your head around this force and this acceleration that's going on. An object travelling in a circle at a steady speed is accelerating. Why is it accelerating? That doesn't make any sense. It's going at a steady speed. Well, the reason it's accelerating is that acceleration is defined as change in velocity. And hopefully you all remember that a velocity not only has a magnitude, i.e. speed, but it also has a direction. If you're going in a circle, the direction is continually changing. If the direction's changing, there must be an acceleration. And of course, if there's an acceleration, there must be a force. Okay? So something travelling at a steady speed around a circle is accelerating, has got a force being applied to it, because its direction is changing. Newton's first law tells us that. Refer back to Newton's first law. Something will keep going in a straight line unless there's a resultant force acting upon it. So for it to be going in a curve, there's got to be a resultant force acting on it. Now we call that resultant force centripetal force. Never use the word centrifugal. Never ever. Never ever. Ever. Centripetal force. The force that's acting upon an object that's making it go in a curve is called a centripetal force. It's not a force by itself. Something else has got to provide it. Something has to provide your centripetal force. Whether it's the tension in the string if you're spinning a rock around your head, or it's the grip of the tyres if you're going in a car around a corner. Something has to provide that centripetal force. Something has to provide the force and acceleration that's getting you around the corner. Now the hardest bit of this is, where direction does that act in? Well, I've tried with groups actually drawing the force diagrams and trying to show that the direction of the change in velocity is towards the centre of the circle. Doesn't particularly matter whether you are happy with those diagrams that I've drawn or not. The bit you have to learn is that the centripetal acceleration, so the change in velocity in something going around a curve, is always towards the centre of the circle. And if the acceleration is towards the centre of the circle, so the resultant force also has to be towards the centre of the circle. Centripetal acceleration, centripetal force, always act towards the centre of a circle. If, for example, the centripetal force should suddenly stop because you've hit a patch of ice and you've lost grip in the tyres, what direction do you carry on in? You carry on tangential to the circle, i.e., you keep going in the straight line, as Newton's first law said you should. For some reason, people have it in their heads that you go out sideways, away from the circle, along the radius, outwards. You don't. You go along a tangent straight. Because there's no longer a force acting on you to make you go round the corner, you carry on in a straight line. Please get that bit in your heads, because they do like to ask questions about that. They'll draw you something going in a circle, whatever it might be. The London Eye was on one of the questions one year. Something going in a circle, and they ask you about what direction the force is acting are in. So you just got to think about those, okay? Centripetal force acts towards the centre of the circle. Reason centripetal force is necessary is because you've got to change direction. Changing direction means changing velocity. To change velocity, you need an acceleration. Where there's an acceleration, there's a force. F equals ma, force equals mass times acceleration. So if you've got a mass, you've got an acceleration, you've got to have a force. Centripetal force, centripetal acceleration. Get those bits stuck in your head, and all the explanations as to the whys and how fors you don't really care about. What else do you need to know about this? Well, a couple of things. Really, all you need to know is what's going to affect the size of force. So what will affect the size of force? Well, if you ride a scooter, you'll know it's a lot harder to get around a tight corner. So the smaller the radius of the circle, the tighter the curve is, the bigger the centripetal acceleration and the bigger the centripetal force necessary to get you round that corner. That's why racing cars always try and make a corner as big as possible. They start from one side of the road, they cross, they hit the apex and they cross to the other side of the road. It's trying to make that curve as big as possible, with as big a radius as possible, so that they need the smallest centripetal force to get round. What else affects it? Well, how fast you're going obviously affects it. The reason why a racing car wants the biggest curve is that he wants to be able to go round as fast as his tyres will allow him to go round. The faster you go, the bigger the centripetal force becomes. Racing car offsets that by doing it in a bigger circle. Bigger circle, smaller centripetal force, faster, bigger centripetal force. So the racing car tries to balance those two out so that he can go around as fast as possible for the grip his tyres are providing. And if he gets it wrong, he carries on in a straight line and he hits the tyre wall. So, increasing the speed increases the centripetal force. Increasing the tightness of the curve, so smaller radius, increases the centripetal force. And of course, because it's a force and we've got force equals mass times acceleration, if you increase the mass, you increase the centripetal force. So you need to know those three effects upon the centripetal force. Other things that can turn up are relatively straightforward. You're given a situation, you're asked what's providing the centripetal force. I've already said, spin a rock around, it's the bit of string. It's tension in the bit of string. It's the tension in the wires on the London Eye. It's the grip of the tyres of a car or a motorbike going round a corner. And the one that we come on to is its gravity if you're talking about something in orbit. Something in orbit is going in a circle around a central point, and that central point tends to have a planet at it or a sun. So something in orbit has a centripetal force acting on it. It has to because it's going in a circle. And that centripetal force turns out to be the gravity of whatever it's going round, whatever it is orbiting. So satellites in orbit around the Earth are there because the gravity of the Earth is providing the centripetal force. And one way of thinking about weightlessness, if you think about the guys on the International Space Station and the fact they're weightless, well, it's not that there's no gravity acting on them. They're still far too close to the Earth for them not to feel gravity. What it is that all the gravity is being used up in providing the centripetal force. There's none left over for them to feel as gravity. Because gravity is providing the centripetal force for them to be able to go in a circle around the Earth. There aren't any left over. That's one way to think of it. It's perhaps not the most mathematical or most scientific, but it seems to work. So, satellites, all that kind of stuff. Satellites, come in two kinds as far as we're concerned. They are low Earth orbit or geosynchronous or geostationary Earth orbit. Now, the truth is there's a whole lot of intermediate orbits as well, but we don't care about those. We only care about low Earth orbit and geostationary orbit, geosynchronous orbit. Things in low Earth orbit. Well, things in low Earth orbit are like the International Space Station. That's in a low Earth orbit. It has to be in quite a low Earth orbit because the shuttle has to be able to get up and get back to it quite regularly. And the shuttle actually doesn't go that high. The highest the shuttle can get above the Earth is about 400 kilometres. So low Earth orbit is somewhere between 200 and 400 kilometres. International Space Station is there. Shuttle goes backwards and forwards to it quite regularly, delivering new people, delivering new kit, building on new modules, etc., etc., etc. The other things that are in low Earth orbit are often in what's called a polar orbit. And they're there in polar orbit because they want to actually image the Earth. So what are they? Well, they're spy satellites, for example. Or they are the satellites that take the pictures for Google Earth. Landsat 7 takes pictures for Google Earth. And if you go on to the school's physics website and have a look at GCSE and Dr. Cook's Year 11, I think you'll probably find some stuff about Landsat 7 that one of the Year 11s a couple of years ago did. So there's things that are actually looking at the Earth, things that are doing investigations into the Earth, things that are doing investigations into what people on the Earth are up to, are all in what's called a polar orbit. Orbit only works if right at the centre of that orbit is the centre of mass of the object you're orbiting around. So the satellites have to be going around the Earth with the centre of the Earth at the centre of their circle of orbit. And they can either do that around the equator, or they can do that around the poles. They can do it lots of other ways as well, but they're the two key ones. If they do it around the poles, they're low down. Low Earth orbit means they're going quite quickly. They're going around the Earth, say, 30 times a day, much more often than the Earth is rotating. When you're close in on an orbit, you're going fast. That's to balance up all the forces and things involved. If you're close in on an orbit, you have to go fast. If you're far out on an orbit, you're going slow. Close in on orbit, you're going fast. You're going around the Earth, say, 30 times a day. But each time you go round, because you're going over the poles, the Earth rotates a bit underneath you, because the Earth, of course, rotates 24 hours a day. So if you take 360 degrees turn of the Earth in a day, and you divide that by 30, the number of times you go over, every time you go over the Earth, then the Earth will have moved by, what's 360 divided by 30? Let me think, blah, 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 12? Yeah, 12 degrees. The Earth will have turned by 12 degrees underneath you every time you go over, which means every time you go over, you photograph a new bit of the Earth, which is quite useful. So things in polar orbit are photographing the Earth in close detail, or doing some investigations into the Earth in close detail, and they do it by turning, going round and round the Earth, and every time they go round, the Earth has shifted a bit and a new bit of the Earth is underneath them for them to photograph. Polar orbit. The alternative is geosynchronous or geostationary orbit. They both mean the same thing. Geosynchronous means in time with the Earth, geostationary means in the same place above the Earth. So there's the clue as to how geosynchronous geostationary orbit works. There is a particular distance from the Earth, very particular distance, get it wrong, and you don't go around at the speed you need to, but there's a particular distance from the Earth where the satellite will do a complete circle in 24 hours, just the same as the fact that the Earth does a complete circle at 24 hours. And if you put something over the equator, so this is an equatorial orbit, if you put something over the equator at that distance, it goes round in 24 hours, the Earth goes round in 24 hours, and so the satellite stays in the same spot above the Earth. It's not still, because both the Earth and the satellite are both going round, but it's above the same spot of the Earth. It's geostationary or it's geosynchronous. And of course that's extraordinarily useful. You don't want, if you're trying to have a communication satellite, you don't want to have to continue to be moving your dish to find where it happens to be at that point. What you want is to be able to point your dish at that, at a spot in the sky and say that satellite is always going to be there. What's the chief geostationary orbit satellite that we know about? Well, of course, it's the sky satellites. We've all got dishes on the side of our houses. They're all aimed at a spot above the equator over North Africa, where a whole set, it's not just one, there's a whole set of TV broadcast satellites are sitting. And that set of TV broadcast satellites are pumping out huge, huge powers, because they're actually a very long way away. Geostationary orbit is at something like 39,000 kilometres away, so not the 400 kilometres, low Earth, 39,000 kilometres away. So they're pumping out a big power down towards us. It spreads out, covers all of Northern Europe. We point our little tiny dishes at it, and our dishes pick up just enough of it for us to be able to pull a TV signal out of them. Of course, you know, you couldn't afford to have your dishes have to move about because the satellite was moving about. It has to be in geosynchronous orbit. So satellite TV, geosynchronous orbit. Most communication satellites, geosynchronous orbit. Things like weather satellites, you know, all those weather satellite pictures you see on the evening news from the BBC. Well, they are all obviously being taken from the same place. And if you look at it and you think about it, you can actually work out that it's being taken by a satellite sort of looking at Northern Europe from somewhere above North Africa. So a lot of weather satellites are geostationary. Certainly the ones you see, the pictures you see on the nightly news, they're taken from geostationary satellites. Geostationary orbit, about 39,000 kilometres away. And once they're there, they pretty much stay there. The orbits are pretty stable. There are things like the Moon and the Sun which have their own pull that tend to knock them out of those orbits. And so those satellites tend to have little jets of nitrogen that they squirt out every now and again just to push themselves back into the geostationary position to make sure they hold position. And eventually what happens is they run out of that gas, to fire the jets, and so eventually they become useless and they need to be replaced. But of course that takes quite a lot of years. The designers know what they're up to, and so design them properly. Okay, that was a lot of talking. So satellites, polar or geostationary orbits, different kinds of satellites. You need to know what the two different sorts of satellites are doing in those two different sorts of orbits. You need to be able to describe those two different sorts of orbits. Geosynchronous is the one that turns up more often because it's much easier to describe than polar orbit is. But polar orbit could appear. Okay, where else am I? I've got to do planets and planetary orbits next, but I'm going to play you some more music first because I really am out of breath now. Oh, it finished. Right, okay, where was I? Planetary orbits. Okay, so I said that with the satellites, the ones that are closer in are going faster. Same with the planets, the ones that are close into the sun are moving faster than the ones that are further out. So Pluto takes an extraordinarily long time to go around the sun, not just because the circle it's got to go round is a lot bigger, but also because it's moving more slowly. So Mercury moves very fast, Pluto moves very slowly, and that's the distance away from the sun that's determining that. And those numbers, how fast they've got to move, are actually relatively easy to calculate, but you don't have to calculate them. It's just a balance between the gravity being applied and the centripetal force necessary. What do I need to tell you about planetary orbits? Well, you just need to understand that planetary orbits are exactly that. They are orbits. It is something going around in a circle, that centripetal force is being applied to get it by the gravity of the sun at the center. Orbits are pretty stable. There is very little in the vacuum slowing the planets down as they go around the sun. So there's no real friction acting to slow them down. So long as the gravity being provided by the sun is exactly the centripetal force necessary to make the planet go in its orbit, it'll stay there. There are some quirks on that. We can't completely disregard the second law of thermodynamics. And you perhaps know that the moon's actually getting a bit further away from us each year. Its orbit's changing very slightly because there's an energy exchange between the Earth and the moon because of the tides. And that energy exchange is actually changing the orbit of the moon around the Earth. Right, what else do you need to know about it? I say this, inner ones go faster, outer ones go slower. And the other thing you need to know is that it turns out that for an orbit to be stable, it doesn't actually have to be perfectly circular. It can be elliptical. An ellipse, an oval, is described mathematically by using two points. A circle just has one point, its centre. An ellipse has two points. And how far away or how close together those two points are determine how far, how flat or how circular a particular ellipse is. And those two points, each one's called a focus. So an ellipse is described using a pair of foci. And it turns out that planets, anything essentially, can go around, can orbit something in an elliptical manner if the thing providing the gravity, i.e. the sun if we're talking about planets, sits at one of those two foci. So the Earth doesn't actually go around in the sun in a perfect circle. It goes around in an ellipse. It's actually pretty close to a circle, but it is an ellipse. And the sun is at the focus, a focus of that ellipse. And the same is true for all of the other planets. You may know that the orbit of Pluto is extremely elliptical. It works because the sun is sat at a focus. Because it's no longer a circle, there's actually a speed change involved in going round an ellipse. A planet sitting on the opposite side of the ellipse to where the focus where the sun is at is moving more slowly than when it's on the same side of the ellipse as where the sun is. So when it's close into the sun, it's moving quickly. When it's a long way from the sun, it's moving more slowly. There's actually a change in speed as it goes around its orbit. If it's in a circular orbit, that doesn't happen. Always at the same speed. If it's in an elliptical orbit, there's actually a change in speed as it goes around the orbit. So you do need to know that. When it's closer into the sun, it's moving faster than when it's further away. Exactly the same as the orbits themselves, so it shouldn't be very difficult for you to remember. I did a diagram for that on that PDF, just to remind you what's going on, and that's figure 2 on the PDF that's available for download along with this podcast. So if you need to have a look at that, please do.